Welcome to episode 5 of the Tech Bubble. This week, as promised, we take some more time to explore the phenomenon of fake news. Certainly not new, of course, but an expression which has become synonymous with election campaigns, the Trump administration, Brexit, and of course, so much more. It should be an intense discussion. I'm your host, Ian Williamson, and today I am lucky enough to be joined by 5 well-informed guests. First up, we have Mary Hoy, a member of our alumni, having left us back in 2010 before she graduated from Lai Po Chun UWC in 2012. She was a prodigious steeplechase runner, having held the Hong Kong junior record before going on to represent Hong Kong. She currently works for Quartz, covering, to quote from her Twitter page, business and geopolitics in Asia, as well as the Hong Kong protests. Formerly, she freelanced and prior to that interned for the Washington Post. And can I just say this is a fantastic opportunity to have her on the show. And thanks very much for your very brave and highly analytic coverage of the Hong Kong protests, Mary. Great to catch up with you again and welcome to the show. Next, good friend of mine and fellow DB resident, Eric Wishart, who's had a long-term career in journalism, having interviewed the likes of Leonard Cohen. We can't talk about that, everyone, too much. It's a family show. Freddie Mercury and Johnny Cash. Wow. He's got an extraordinary collection of memorabilia associated with Bob Dylan. And in more recent years, Eric was the AFP editor-in-chief here in Hong Kong and now responsible for special editorial projects. He lectures in journalism at HKU and HKBU and is the vice president of the Hong Kong Foreign Correspondents Club. Eric has also helped me up with our unique offering here at South Island of the AFP Media Educational Certificate that's offered to students in years 10 and 11. He's also lectured several times for our TOK students. Actually, you're a bit of a jack of all trades, aren't you, Eric? Welcome to the Tech Bubble.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to have Zach Jones from 11C1 on the show for the first time. Zach has completed internships with the SEMP and writes regularly for the Young Post. Sadly, Zach will be leaving South Island at the end of this year. That doesn't matter, Zach. We do the show remotely, so you don't get away that easily. Zach will be attending King Edward VI College in Stourbridge, from where we hope he will still be a regular on the show. Welcome, Zach. Are you excited about the move?
Yes, it's pretty sad, but it is what it is.
Okay, well, good luck with that when it comes. Then we have 2 students from the DLC this week. I did actually try my hardest to dissuade Sam from appearing again. He's very thick-skinned, listeners, and said he would hack my school account and pretend I supported Man United, and there's no way I can let him do that. So I had to have him back on the show. Actually, on a more serious note, I know Sam has some very, very strong opinions on the issues of fake news that we're going to be talking about today. So great to welcome him back on the show. Also back with us is Chloe Jazzy Lau, driving force behind the You Matter organization, a project supporting students with special needs through digital literacy education, something that I've been supporting Chloe with as well for the last couple of years, and I believe in very strongly. A terrific initiative, Chloe. And actually, this seems a good place to start this week. So before we get into the murky, solid world of fake news, let's discuss something a little bit more positive. Chloe, can you give us an update on the You Matter initiative? And also, I guess, is there anything that our listeners can do to help?
Yeah, thanks for the introduction. So just a quick update, we ran the You Matter Week in 2019 and raised almost 10,000 Hong Kong dollars to support Thomas House, a special needs school in Thailand. We also recently just won a grant that allowed us to fund over 500 care packages to send to families with kids with special needs or disabilities. And then we are also running the You Matter Week in 2020, which is an awareness week that will include digital literacy workshops for individual needs students, live music and game stalls in 4 different schools in Hong Kong. We're also in the process of planning additional digital literacy workshops. So we will consistently update our social media page. So just follow us on the UMatterOrg on Instagram and visit our website at umatterhk.org for regular updates and any volunteer opportunities in the future.
Thanks for that, Chloe. Yeah, keep up the great work. And if I could just reinforce that, you know, any of you who are out there, particularly those of you who are maybe in year 11 at the moment, going into year 12, and if you're looking for some really great CAS initiatives to get involved with, this could be a good one for you. Now, during our second podcast, I spoke with our vice principal, Lucy Purvis, about the growing threat to student well-being caused by fake news. It seems that we cannot escape this phenomenon in the modern world. However, Eric, I'm going to start with you. How would you define fake news? And do you see this as a new phenomenon or something that's been around for a while?
I mean, there's a lot of discussion about whether you should even use the term fake news before. Some people think it's been devalued through overuse, but I think it's become part of the language. So I think we should use it, but we have to define it. And I think for the sake of this kind of discussion, I think we can just use it as a generic term that just covers all forms of disinformation, misinformation. The difference between disinformation and misinformation being disinformation implies it's deliberately trying to mislead people with an objective at the end of it. where misinformation can just be the innocent spread of false information that somebody's seen and just shared, for example, on Facebook. There's no malicious intent. So, I mean, fake news, it just covers everything. I mean, obviously, the main source of it tends to be what is shared online or on social media, but it can cover everything from malicious messages in India, WhatsApp groups that lead to people being lynched, to Russian disinformation campaigns, to some of the rumours swirl around Hong Kong when there are protests or when there's a virus, which can end up in us running out of toilet paper. So it really covers a multitude. And I mean, just on your second point, it's definitely not new. As long as people have been able to communicate, they've told falsehoods, and it's just in the sort of, but kind of relatively modern era, I would say the first real example of what we would recognise as fake news goes back to the New York Sun in 1835, when they published a series of articles that astronomer had, using this giant telescope, had discovered a colony living on Mars of man bats, these humanoids with bats, right? And it's quite interesting. It's probably the first viral fake news story. Obviously, this slightly predates the internet, but it was picked up in newspapers around the world, including in Europe, where it was translated. So if you want to look at the first viral fake news story, you probably have to go back to 1835. So as a phenomenon, it's not new. What has obviously changed it is the impact of social media, and also the ease with which you can create it and upload it and spread it to a global audience.
Obviously, that's where Orson Welles got his idea from then, eh?
Yeah.
When you've come into school, you've talked quite a bit also about propaganda. And I know that you feel there's a strong connection there between fake news and understanding propaganda, and even variations between different types of propaganda, which perhaps many listeners would never have heard of. Can you explain that a little bit to some of our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, propaganda as a term pops up a lot, and it's always used in a negative sense, of course. And I think it's really something some people should study and understand, because you can't really understand the fake news phenomenon without understanding propaganda. And I mean, propaganda as a term goes back to the 17th century Roman Catholic Church, when it was a commission that was created to propagate the faith. That was the origin of propaganda. And it wasn't really used that much as a term, probably until the First World War, at which point it took on this very negative connotation. But a man called Edward Bernays, who worked with the American government during the First World War, recognised the value of propaganda and the value it could have in the private sector. But obviously, by then, it had this sort of pejorative sense. So he renamed it as public relations. So propaganda goes back quite a long way. And there are multiple definitions. But I mean, to define propaganda really, in simple terms, I would just say that it's a way of spreading information to promote an idea, a political ideology, a political campaign, or other kind of ideology, with the intention of influencing the way people think about it. And, I mean, it can be done in any form. It can be Cultural Revolution posters, it can be Nazi propaganda films, it can be Russian influence campaigns. But you have to understand that so much of what we see these days can be covered by propaganda. And again, what you said, Ian, yeah, there's different kinds of propaganda. What we call white propaganda is propaganda where you know who is spreading the propaganda. So the Cultural Revolution poster, of course, you know where the source of that is. Black propaganda is where the source is, or the propagandist is hidden. So, for example, the Russians putting a Black Lives Matter Facebook page to sort of stir up trouble in the American election, that was black propaganda.
Is there also like a grey propaganda, like in the middle, where you kind of really can't tell who it's from?
Yeah, and that can be quite effective. I mean, it's grey, so obviously by definition it's a kind of grey zone. But I would say that, for example, a government planting stories through anonymous sources in a newspaper, which then repeats it, is a very effective way of spreading grey propaganda, because it gives it a credibility that perhaps it wouldn't have if it actually came from an official source. So yeah, you have these, you have white, black, and then you have the grey in the middle. But it's a fascinating subject. And as I said, it's linked to the whole fake news disinformation universe. So because so much of fake news and disinformation has a propaganda objective.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The whole notion of propaganda seems to be integrated into kind of marketing and what we would probably call spin in a modern context. these kind of marketing practices that the likes of Joseph Goebbels, perhaps used quite hugely, really, and had, in fact, an entire role built around it. I'm not saying that all, as you said before, propaganda, it's a subjective reading as to whether it's perceived to be good, bad, or indifferent, but it's certainly become the way of most governments, I think, in terms of spreading their message.
I think there's just one historic fact that people don't understand, actually, is that Joseph Goebbels was the propaganda minister under the Nazis, under Adolf Hitler, but the mastermind behind the Nazi propaganda machine was Adolf Hitler. After the First World War, not accepting that the Germans could have lost militarily, he thought it was because the British propaganda was more effective than the German propaganda. And in Mein Kampf, he goes into great detail about propaganda. He talks about the big lie, and he starts his anti-Semitic theorizing as well.
The big lie, by the way, is nowadays just called the Jewish question, and we'll get to that later on.
But if you study Goebbels, if you study propaganda, and to study propaganda, you have to study Goebbels, and you look at Goebbels, so much of what he actually did came from Hitler's writings on propaganda. And to understand the present, you have to understand the past, and so much of how they spread their poison under the Nazi regime is repeated in the techniques we see today.
Absolutely. In fact, very much, I think he was probably the face of the kind of propaganda that we saw during the war. Absolutely. I think Hitler was certainly the archetype of the ideas itself. Mary, from your perspective, I mean, obviously we've come up with a lot of different kind of synonyms and discussion points there about fake news. Where do you stand on this in terms of the reporting that you've done? I mean, obviously you've covered both the protests and more recently, obviously, stuff to do with the coronavirus pandemic. So how do you approach something like fake news?
Yeah, I think I share Eric's ambivalence with the term fake news. I certainly agree that it's a very important generic catch-all to describe the concept. But I think on the one hand, it's easy to just point at something and say that's fake news rather than actually provide a solid and concrete kind of breakdown of what's false and what isn't. Many pieces of fake news have some kernels of truth in it sometimes, and it is important to pick those out and explain fully what is real and what isn't. On the flip side, I think governments are prone to doing this. Particularly, they kind of weaponize the idea of fake news because the state has this stamp of credibility and legitimacy. They have a powerful propaganda machine and the control of information flow and sources, and they are able to sometimes just use this label of fake news against anyone that is pushing back against the political establishment, and through that push for, say, anti-fake news bills that we've seen, for example, in Singapore and that are being promoted elsewhere, and through that trying to push for more censorship. So I think the term fake news is important to try and provide a framework for us in thinking about the whole spectrum of disinformation and misinformation and manipulation and inaccuracies and the like. But I think we also have to be quite careful with kind of the pitfalls of using the term fake news too often. And then just to bring it to the local context a little bit, I think with the coronavirus pandemic, earlier in January, February, we saw huge runs to stores for toilet paper, for example, and that we saw then ripple out throughout the world. And that started in Hong Kong with probably a WhatsApp text that got passed around about shortages of toilet paper coming from elsewhere, and that, you know, the border controls were being ramped up. And that was very much fake. But at the same time, what is real is that people were afraid. And all you need is an extra bunch of people stopping at the store after work and getting one extra roll of toilet paper than they otherwise would have to cause a shortage. So that part of it is very real. So I think labeling it completely fake news misses that nuance a little bit.
So it comes back to almost like terminology as well, doesn't it? I mean, fake news can be sometimes perhaps exaggerated as a concept, that everything is being labeled as fake news, when actually, you know, if we go back historically, for instance, being selective with statistics is something that politicians forever and ages have done. I mean, you know, how close is that to fake news when you're only cherry picking one statistic that happens to suit your purpose whilst ignoring all of the other statistics in a white paper, for instance, or some form of research that contradicts your point? So yeah, some good points there. Zach, maybe bringing you in here as well, maybe from the student perspective. I mean, you've worked on the SCMP. Did you have any issues there? I mean, you know, you've been working on the Young Post, I believe, and the publications.
So working for a student newspaper, we always try and get a lot of quotes from different students and different sort of perspectives. So one of the things that we found lately is that a lot of people are really unwilling to share their names. And this has led to a massive uptick in the amount of anonymous sources that are being listed in the news, pretty much universally as well. And one issue with this is that as a reader, we can't really tell where the quotes are coming from. a lot of newspapers will now quote like an anonymous insider or something like that. And I think as a reader and as someone who writes, it can be hard to convey legitimacy. And that is a major issue that comes with these big protests at the moment.
Eric, I think you've got a point to make there.
Yeah, I would just jump in. If you want to go online and look at AFP Charter online, you'll see I wrote the ethics for AFP and also 20 principles of sourcing, the guidelines to sourcing. Don't use anonymous sources unless you absolutely have to. Just persevere and find someone who's willing to go on the record, okay? You should only use an anonymous source if you absolutely have to. And there's just too much reporting at the moment of just quoting somebody in a protest saying something. I mean, what value does that have? I mean, unless they're an absolutely key person and their life's in danger or they could end up in jail, just keep looking for people until you'll get somebody on the record. There's just far too much of this. And if you do use an anonymous source, explain why, okay? And give as much detail about the person as possible.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But I think looking at it from the perspective of a reader, it can be hard when media uses sort of anonymous sources, because inevitably there will be a lot of use of it, especially during highly sensitive times like these, where we don't know what's going to happen in Hong Kong. Come 2047, people could be arrested. And that is maybe a bit far off, but there is a slight possibility. So inevitably, in quite sensitive times like this, it will happen. And looking at it from a reader perspective, it can be hard to distinguish the credibility of said anonymous sources.
Chloe.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Zach in that I feel like these are very sensitive times, especially, you know, the turmoil that we faced over this year as Hong Kongers. And I agree with Zach in terms of, you know, not many people are willing to put their names on record, but I think it's still valuable to have anonymous sources in my perspective when I'm reading news articles, because I'm getting various perspectives. I'm getting perspectives from individuals that don't want to be named because of legal issues, individuals that might be in the police force, but having their name on record would perhaps interfere with their occupation. So I think for me as a teenage reader myself, it's really valuable to get different perspectives. And I think as teenage reporters especially, it's difficult to find people that are willing to put their name on record, especially since, you know, you're a teenager and it's your reach in terms of reach is quite difficult. So that's kind of how I see anonymity in news sources.
I take your point, Chloe, but isn't the danger there that if, you know, we become used to anonymous sources, that journalists can then literally incorporate, you know, it's a bit like Fox News. There was a program created on Fox News a few years ago called Outfoxed, and they tend to say things like, some people would say, and that's the use of catch-all for, we want to now express an opinion, like a kind of counterclaim, usually when they've got a Democrat on the show and they're interviewing the Democrat. And some people would say, really, is just an opportunity to try and suggest that there's this sort of hidden mass audience out there that would disagree with the opinion that's just been made. So I suppose the danger there is that, you know, we get to the stage where maybe we've got anonymous sources that are being incorporated into writing, which are just made up, essentially. Sam and then Eric, I'll get a couple more thoughts on this before we go on.
Yeah, Chloe, I vehemently disagree with you when you say that anonymous sources are a good thing. I think especially in these shaky times, these unpredictable times, precisely when we do need named proper sources, because as Mr. Williamson said, it's too easy to use fake quotes to set up things like straw men, or to just, you know, in bad faith to make the others look bad, or to make yourself look worse, or to change the way argument is perceived. For example, I've been interviewed by a couple of people, I think like you guys might know him, Jerome Taylor. And I've always made sure to at least give my first name so that people reading know that there's a person with an identity behind the claims that were just made. So I think precisely in these times, we need, you know, named proper sources.
Eric?
Yeah, and I would say that, I think it was Chloe, was it Chloe said it, that it's difficult. Nobody said it's easy. Yeah, you said it was difficult to get people to put their names on the record. Yeah, that's the job of a journalist. Don't take the easy route. At one point, somebody talked about anonymous police sources. Then you're in the realms of disinformation being spread through the media from the police. The police don't want to go on the record, don't quote them. If it's some kind of controversial thing or they're criticism. Another good lesson on using anonymous sources, only use anonymous sources for factual information. Never quote an anonymous source giving an opinion, okay? If you can't get the factual information any other way, use an anonymous source. Don't ever use an anonymous source giving an opinion, like in an analysis. That has no value. But Mary, what's your approach on anonymous sources?
I think it's important to take into account the political context and the power relations that come with that. So, for example, I completely agree that when quoting, say, a police officer speaking as an official, as a representative of an extension of the government in the Hong Kong context, then it is very important to get their names. We do want to put a name to this official's face. But in the case of a protester, for example, given context of Hong Kong, given how the colonial laws are set up here, the fact that you are in the vicinity of what is defined to be a riot makes you a rioter and liable to 10 years of imprisonment, means that even just by speaking to a reporter and giving them your full name and saying, you know, even if you were just standing there chanting slogans and not throwing anything, you could be liable to being charged with rioting with severe consequences. And as a reporter, I would never want to put a source in that position and jeopardize their futures. But I think at the same time, it is important to get their perspective. And in this case, I guess it would both be factual and, you know, what they were doing, what they saw, but also probably their opinion, why they're out here and what they think.
I'd just like to say this is great, by the way. I mean, you know, you pay for this stuff at Hong Kong U, you know? So this is brilliant for you listeners out there who are picking up on all of these tips at the moment. It's like a class in how to do journalism well and with some kind of ethical backbone as well. I'm going to bring the three students in on at this point and just ask you a more kind of a wider question now, which is, given that the problems of fake news that we've articulated so far, I mean, how do you go about, or how do you think young people generally go about combating these issues? I mean, what sort of things have propped up for you and how do you go about trying to combat those problems? Zach, if you want to start us off.
So I think probably the biggest distinction between young people and the older generation is that we get our news in a completely different way. I think the majority of teenagers and young people, we don't really use news apps and websites, we don't buy newspapers, and the majority of the news we consume is on social media. And the biggest issue with that is that anyone can put something on social media. And I've done a bit of work with Young Post, and I've also done a bit of social media reporting, as in I've gone to events and covered them using Instagram and Facebook Live and stuff like that. I can say from experience, it's not a hard thing to do. Anyone can do it. And one of the biggest issues with this is that there's not the same oversight if any Instagram account can go out and start reporting. And the issue is that a lot of young people don't have the ability to distinguish major news sources, which have got ways to fact check. Bigger news corporations will have repercussions if they publish something incorrect. Normally, it will be a massive blunder to them if it's something really big. However, there aren't that same repercussions for just anyone with any account on Instagram. And that's something that is becoming a massive issue because social media is available to everyone. And unlike maybe back 20 years ago, where it took massive resources to publish a newspaper, it doesn't take the same resources to do it on Instagram. And we've seen the massive rise of accounts such as the International Students Anti-E-Lab, which has been one of the go-to pages for many students for news on the protests. And they are basically just a group of secondary students who just happen to have phones. And they have posted a lot of things which have been incorrect and untrue. You can see if you go back a few months and you go back through the content they published, a lot of the facts that they put aren't correct. And they haven't gone back and sort of said, this has been wrong, unlike what would happen on another sort of news site. And this is probably one of the main reasons why fake news is rising up in prevalence nowadays, because of the massive shift in the way we consume news.
It's that move away from what used to be called the gatekeeper model, yeah? Those kind of gatekeepers of news. And even, you know, productions like The Sun, with all of the criticism you know, leveled at it in the UK, were still forced from time to time to have to go onto their front cover and say, we got that wrong. They didn't do it very well, of course. Zach?
A newspaper like The Sun has a rubbish reputation anyways. So when you read The Sun, I think you almost expect that some things are going to be a bit off or a bit biased. You can understand what a newspaper's position is. But an Instagram account, while you can understand the position, I think young people are a lot more vulnerable to that sort of thing. I've definitely sort of jumped the gun on a few things I've seen on Instagram myself. I have definitely also, you know.
It's interesting you were talking there about different demographic groups. I mean, Eric and I have talked before about the Pew Research Center and the kind of fantastic findings from there. And I've often used in my teaching a breakdown of the different demographic groups where they'll classify generations as, you know, the maturists, the baby boomers, you know, Generation X, Y, Z, and into the kind of millennials. Apparently, it's Generation Alpha coming, by the way. They're the ones the next few years who will see more change than ever before. We just saw today a leaked release that the Apple Glass may well be coming later on this year or the beginning of next year. Is that going to transform our society with augmented reality that we talked a little bit about last week? Chloe, to bring you in and also Sam, what are your thoughts on perhaps, you know, following up on what Zach just said?
Yeah, for me, the thing about fake news is whether you're a young person or not, I think it really plays into our political and personal biases, regardless of how true the news is. Because when anyone goes through that process where they rationalize that information, it's natural for us to compare it to our own beliefs, right? To see whether it affirms our prejudices. If it fits, we send it, we spread it as if it were the truth. So a really good example of this is alcoholics who believe alcohol is a cure for the coronavirus. So they send out news articles that have very flashy headlines of drink alcohol and you will be immune to the virus or something of that sort. And, you know, it kind of just hinges on to a lot of people's different biases. And another example is the false information about the spread of coronavirus in China is used to spark xenophobia in a lot of parts of the world. So we can see how, you know, fake news, it can be spread, but also it really shows us where these individual biases are and what their individual stances are in terms of what kind of news they share on social media platforms. And I just wanted to follow up on Zach's point that young adults, and I think teenagers, are definitely more susceptible to fake news because of how accustomed most teenagers are to spreading information. I feel like they've kind of decreased the friction of spreading information in the sense that you can just click a button and the information would be sent to a group chat of 50 people or 100 people. It's just so much easier to spread that information now. We are fortunate enough at SIS to have a good amount of information in terms of avoiding fake news from our Digital Leaders Council to the AFP Media course. And I think we're always striving to increase digital literacy, whether on our campus or for primary students. That's a step in the right direction that schools are taking at the moment.
I mean, can I ask all five of you, you know, based on what we've just been saying there, we're thinking about teenagers, and obviously you're responding to a question specifically there. But my point about adults, and in particular, perhaps the grey market, are these guys not vulnerable too? Trump wasn't elected, was he, by teenagers? A lot of the fake news that circulated that led to Trump's election, which, you know, later on was proven to be false, coming out of all kinds of countries, not just in America, of course, but, you know, potentially from Russia and other places. It seems to me that there was an older audience that were particularly vulnerable to that information, you know, living in their own little filter bubbles and looking for information that fits with a worldview that they themselves have. Any responses to that?
Yes, I actually wanted to mention this earlier as well. People won't only just see news sources and be like, oh, I gotta share this. You often see with these, especially during the Trump campaign, and especially political propaganda targeted at boomers, it'll be some political message like, the Democrats want to kill babies, share this to 20 of your friends, I bet you won't, if you don't, you're not a true patriot, or Facebook is trying to delete this, share this to your friends so they can see it before the Democrat media can take care. Things like that. Things where, like, basically, like a pseudo call to action. Like, share this post to, like, 20 of your friends, or oops, that really help it spread. Like wildfire, actually. Even people who you'd think are more tech-savvy share these kinds of image macros, and, yeah, that's how they spread.
And during Brexit, of course, as well, is another kind of major example. If we can just sort of go back to some of the points that we made earlier on, where we were talking about kind of, you know, mainstream media and this need for proper fact-checking. But Eric, we'll go to you first.
Yeah, baby boomer sounds quite good, actually. The kind of elderly kind of label I don't like so much. But people of my generation, I'm 65, I'm just shocked at my contemporaries who believe all these conspiracy theories. These are people I've known a long time, and then in the last few years, it's all come out. I mean, I even commented on somebody's Facebook. You know Facebook's for the old generation these days, but this guy who I know quite well, who's probably similar ages to me, just has this stream of posts about the coronavirus and how it's not as bad as the... there was one today, you know, 60,000 people died of the flu and why don't we have a lockdown? And I mean, I know people now of my own generation who say they didn't. The moon landing was staged and 9/11 was staged. And to me, it's like this must have been latent and it's come out now, you know. And
like sleeper agents.
Yeah. And there's somebody I know in DB who just keeps bombarding me on WhatsApp with these crazy YouTube videos we talked about.
It's not me, everyone, by the way.
And, I mean, it's just insane. And I was just wondering, I mean, is this a generational thing? I mean, you know, young people rightly looking on, you know, feeds on Instagram and all the rest of it from live, you know, live videos from their friends or down at the scene of protests is one thing, but is there such a constituency in the young generation, as we say, you guys?
Not at all, actually. It's so prolific with boomers, as I mentioned, that there are whole communities on like Reddit and things that are just dedicated to boomer humor, that kind of stuff, where it's like specifically boomer. It's not something that young people do.
Chloe or Zach, anything that you have to say in response to that? But
yeah, I think if you grow up with these sort of things, like not to trust the government and stuff like that, once you progress through your life, you start to believe that a lot of the stuff you see on the internet. And I think in Hong Kong, we have got a lot of it in young people, especially with anything to do with the government. But also, I think older people, especially in the Western world, they start to believe pretty much whatever they see. I also think a lot of it comes down to digital literacy. They don't understand how to interpret data that comes off the computers and the internet. And I think that might be a major point of it. And because anyone can publish anything, as I said before, there's now a massive wealth of information which supposedly prove anti-vax, flat earth theories and stuff like that. And obviously a lot of it's completely incorrect and just outlandish. But the thing is that there's a lot of it that claims it, and you can spend hours researching into it. The more you spend looking into it, the more that it will support what you've thought originally. There was a study, I can't really remember exactly what it was called, but if you go against someone's belief, they will only just reinforce their beliefs even further. Because of that, it's really hard to change people's minds. And possibly because if everyone on the internet can always shout at, and we can engage into quite some strong battles on the internet about different viewpoints, I think this makes people shift to different extremes nowadays, and it has sort of led to some really crazy conspiracy theories, as I've said, like anti-vax, flat earth, maybe even nowadays the 5G causes coronavirus, and so many different other things that it can be dangerous because the amount of stuff that is on the internet.
If I could jump in real quick here, sorry, Mr. Williamson, but especially like the boomers grew up in a generation where the government was just constantly lying to them. I mean, you know, the hundreds of CIA-backed coups, the Vietnam War, and so on and so on. I guess for the older generation has kind of, in a Pavlovian kind of way, conditioned them to not believe the government.
That's why, of course, Sam, that Trump was elected on the back of that, because the more established political hierarchy in American politics, you know, the Bush family, etc., debacle, you know, the Clinton administration, things like that, people lost faith, didn't they? They wanted somebody different.
Yeah, people perceived Trump to be outside of the system, you know, an outsider, not a career politician. Although, here I'd like to make you guys aware of a quote, I think it was from Zizek, who said, sometimes things that we perceive to be outside of the system are precisely the product of the system, saying that essentially Trump is not outside of the system, he is part of it, he is the system, which is why he is so dangerous. But that's for later on.
Yeah, I think anecdotally it does seem like the older generation is dealing more with the fake news, conspiracy theories, but I don't think personally I would be able to say that I know my generation enough of a cross-section of my generation to say that we are much less susceptible to it. Just thinking back to, say, like the Boston Marathon bombing, when a bunch of people on the internet started doing a ton of detective work, thinking that they were very technically savvy and doing all sorts of photo captions and lines and looking at the bulging backpack. And that ended up being entirely wrong. And I would think that that drew a younger audience of internet users on Reddit and Twitter. So I don't think we are immune to that. And perhaps the younger generation might be dealing with misinformation and fake news and peddling in that in a more subtle way that we might not even right now register as dealing in fake news and conspiracy theories in as kind of blatant a way as maybe some other generations are. And maybe it's just manifesting in more subtle ways that we are not catching on to right now.
That's a great point, Mary. Excellent example. Eric?
Yeah, I mean, you talked about, you know, lack of belief in what governments say. And I mean, you know, Ian, I'm working in this book about fake news. And one of the things I looked at was really if there's a real credibility problem in the kind of digital social media age with governments. I would trace it back to the war in Iraq when I was editor-in-chief of AFP. I was living in a parallel universe. My job at that time was organising the coverage of the war in Iraq and the build-up. And the American and British governments were pushing this, what turned out be a lie that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. But from the people I was talking to, weapons inspectors, everybody knew there weren't any. It was a war in false pretenses. And then, of course, subsequently, I knew the State Department spokesman, I knew the Pentagon spokesman, and, of course, there was nothing. You know, and then last two, three weeks ago, when this story came out that Kim Jong-un was brain dead or gravely ill or whatever, and they were quoting US intelligence sources, to me, it was just disinformation. I didn't believe it for a second. Or their sources were the same sources that everybody else had, which was this newspaper in South Korea run by, I think it's North Korean defectors. But I think that's healthy to be skeptical and challenge governments from that experience of Iraq, and as you said. But I think there's a difference between being healthily skeptical and going down that rabbit hole of conspiracy theory.
Can I ask you, Eric, then? I mean, if you're one of the younger viewers listening to this program, and obviously, you know, we've talked a bit about the AFP. Why should they trust the AFP?
So coming back to trust in the media, you know, as you said, Ian, I don't like the concept of trust. To me, trust implies a leap of faith. Like somebody's holding on to you and you say, trust me, I won't let you go. Okay, there's a leap of faith there. What I want people to do with AFP or competition Reuters or AP or the New York Times or whatever big news organization is, why should I think the news they publish is credible? And the way you do it is you go online and you look at their sourcing guidelines, which I talked about earlier. If AFP quotes an anonymous source, why are they doing it? What are their rules for quoting an anonymous source? If I see an AFP photograph, what are their rules for photoshopping? If I see an AFP video, if I see an AFP graphic, and as we know, graphics are very easily manipulated, on what basis were these things produced? And all credible media organizations publish this information, their ethical rules, their style books. So on the basis of that, you can decide if the AFP or whoever else is a credible news organization. I don't want you to trust. I want you to make a value judgment that based on this, just as if you go into a doctor's surgery, based on the certificates on the wall, you know this person has done the studies and is an expert in the field.
And a professional, in fact.
And a professional. So I think that's how you establish trust. I think we're the BBC, AFP, we've been around since 1835, so trust us. I think that ship has long sailed. I think you've got to establish your credentials. Yeah.
Good answer. To finish with, in 30 seconds or less, what tips would you give our listeners for avoiding falling foul to the spread of fake news? Sam, do you want to start us off?
So my tip would be, if you're watching any kind of political YouTube videos about, you know, whatever, especially if they're conservative or right-wing, you know, videos perpetuating those kind of ideologies, always make sure to check the sources, because you may find sometimes the sources don't match what the people are actually saying. Or also find response videos from people on the other side of the aisle breaking down those kind of arguments and those kind of channels. Also, if you guys have the time, watch the video called How to Fall Down the Anti-SJW Rabbit Hole by Three Arrows on YouTube. That's a great intro to how the kind of conservative YouTube political sphere works.
Great. And in fact, Sam, that sounds interesting. I mean, maybe we could get into a little bit more of those kind of the use of YouTube, for instance, as a source of news. We've not had the chance really to say too much about that today. So I imagine I know what the answer is here, but would you be willing to come back again for another episode, Sam?
Let me think. Yes, I'd love to.
Very well said, Sam. Zach, what about you? What tips would you give?
I think it's very important to look at different news sources because, A, it's important to widen your horizon on different sort of perspectives because each news outlet will have its different perspective, but also because fake news starts at one source. And it's more likely that if you look at different sources, you'll be able to distinguish what is real and what isn't. So if you only download one news app, find one that allows you to browse many different sources. And one good one is Google News. They nowadays allow you to see a full coverage from many different news sources and allows you to really help distinguish what is real and what isn't.
One really good source I would mention to everyone, by the way, is Trusta Vista. If you've got in the school library, Ms. Au can set you up there with an account so you can explore and post news articles into, you know, into like a search engine. And get kind of like a, you won't like this, Eric, but a trust rating. From your point of view, Zach, I just wanted to also make such an important point that you were making there about trying to kind of, you know, reach beyond your own political views. For me online, I try very, very hard to deliberately ask people questions who have different political values from my own. And I think if we don't try and do that, we've got no chance at all. Chloe.
Yeah, I'd say take caution with overly sensationalized headlines and read beyond the headlines. So I think it's important that before you, you know, send out information that you find from a news source, identify your biases and see whether there's anything intrinsic that's driving you to kind of make this subjective decision without learning whether the news is real or false. So I think it's important to identify your biases and prejudices and realize, am I spreading this for a good reason? What are my intentions with spreading this news source? And I think when in doubt, definitely use a fact checker like Snopes. That's always useful to give you an objective view of the news article at hand.
Yep, great resource, Snopes. I've used it for many years. Mary?
I would say just to slow down, and before you click retweet or resend or forward, just stop and put on your critical, super skeptical hat and just try to think why anyone is sending this to you, what the motivations might be, whether it's too good to be true, whether it's too dramatic. And then once you've kind of gone through a list and you feel good about retweeting it or sharing it, then go ahead, but otherwise don't.
Last but not least, Eric.
I would say you should develop your own list of credible information sources, be it an established media or kind of aspiring amateur journalist out in the field. And it can be the BBC or it can be an individual, and people have their own credibility. If I see Mary tweeting from the field, I'll retweet her. Other people I won't, because they're not credible. So I think you have to dial it back. For each topic or area of coverage, have sources, go-to sources. And again, totally in agreement with Mary. I feel like we should have a big sign saying, what's the rush? Take your time. This panic to share. And when I have classes or I do talks, I always say to people, hands up, who shared a story without actually reading it based on the headline? And everybody has. If you don't put your hand up, you're not honest. So take your time. There's no rush. You can read it. Don't just share it, okay?
It seems incredible, doesn't it, that in this day and age we have to say those kind of things, but it's a mark really of the way we live our lives when you're commenting on the fact that people are sharing material without having read it. It'd be like making a recommendation for a book 20 years ago that you'd never read based on the cover. Crazy. Anyway, that's just about all we have time for today, everyone. I'd like to thank my five guests. Episode 6 is going to be coming up soon and we'll focus on coding. That's been demanded by the students, staff and parents alike, with computer science coming to South Island School very soon. And we'll be discussing the timeline for that and the advances in computer programming in recent years. Predictably, Sam has asked to be on the show again, so I've had no choice but to invite him back for an unprecedented third show. However, it should be fun. It should be very good. We'll also have Mr. Tom Lee, who's going to be teaching that course, on the show with us as well. If you've got any thoughts, questions, or feedback, then please write to digileaders@webmail.sis.edu.hk. Thanks for listening. Speak again soon.